Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome to RBG Beyond Notorious. This is the podcast that takes you behind the scenes of the CNN film RBG and explores the life of Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'm Poppy Harlow, and I'm joined by CNN's chief legal analyst, Jeffrey Toobin. And in our last episode, we talked with Eugene Scalia about the very special friendship between his father and RBG that dates back to the 80s. In this 70s episode, we'll hear from Steven Weisenfeld and Sharon Cohen, whose gender discrimination cases RBG fought in front of the Supreme Court.
She sat me at the table with her. She had never before had a client sit at the table and hadn't done it afterward. I was the only client to ever sit there. I was not introduced, and she just wanted to show the eight male justices what a male looked like when he was the plaintiff.
I realized that I wasn't getting the housing allowance that men were getting, married men were getting. And it was not insignificant.
So Jeffrey Toobin, she is this flaming feminist litigator in the 70s and in the midst of the women's movement and the fight for equality. Women are fighting for equal pay, the opportunity to serve in equal jobs to men. This is Roe versus Wade time. This is quite a moment in American history.
You know, my mother, Marlene Sanders, yeah, was a contemporary of Justice Ginsburg's in many respects. And she was a flaming feminist journalist.
There you go.
And one of the things she always reminded me was, you know, a lot of people think the 60s were the time of liberal change in America. Mm-hmm. But she said for women, the 70s were the decade that really matters. The 60s was the Civil Rights Revolution. You had the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. But women were not really at the center of that movement. But it was really in the 1970s that women's rights became a national fixation. 1973, of course, is Roe v. Wade, when the Supreme Court's decided 7-2 that states could no longer ban abortion. At the same time, women, in many respects, led by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, were trying to undo all the other forms of discrimination against women, the likes of which are even hard to imagine today because they seem so ancient in their approach. You know, women couldn't get credit cards independent of their husbands. Women couldn't buy real estate independent of their husbands. You know, child custody cases. I mean, it was all over the law books of the states, of the federal government, that men and women were treated differently. Ruth Ginsburg was the leading pioneer of women's rights, and that's why she will be a major figure in American legal history, even without considering her service as a judge.
She ran the women's rights project at the ACLU. Gloria Steinem said about her, "Ruth's work made me feel I was protected by the Constitution for the first time." But it was challenging for her because often she would be fighting these cases and presenting them in front of all male judges. So,
as she was throughout her career in the U.S. Supreme Court.
Right.
It wasn't until 1981, when Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed, the first woman to the court, mm-hmm, that there was a woman on the Supreme Court. So every time she argued to the Supreme Court,
all men,
it was an all-male bench. And as she argued in lower courts, it was virtually
almost
the same thing.
Here's what she told me about it when we sat down back in February.
The challenge in those now ancient days was to get judges to understand that there was such a thing as gender-based discrimination. The thought was that women are sheltered, that they are protected, that they are cared for by their men, so they're sheltered from working at night. They're sheltered from being police officers, firefighters. And that notion, when men would think of themselves as good husbands, good fathers. Mm-hmm. And Brennan was responding to that. He said, when he said, the pedestal on which women have been thought to stand more often than not turns out to be a cage.
Explain that important argument by Justice Brennan that she's talking about there.
Well, you know, this was why arguing these cases was so challenging for Ginsburg, because a lot of these laws were portrayed and believed to be for the protection of women,
right,
not discrimination against women. Now, when African Americans were told they couldn't ride in the front of the bus, no one thought that was for their protection. But when women were told you can't be a police officer, you can't be a firefighter, you can't have a job where you have to work at night, that was thought an act of solicitude, not an act of discrimination. But she, Justice Ginsburg here is quoting Justice William Brennan in an early women's rights opinion where he said, the pedestal, you know, putting women mm-hmm. as actually a cage, that when you tell women for your own benefit you can't do this job because it's too dangerous, you are actually penalizing them. You're not protecting them.
She argued six cases before the Supreme Court. She won five.
She won five.
What stands out?
Well, what stands out, and we have someone particularly well-suited to discuss this, is that Ginsburg understood that the all nine men on the Supreme Court might not identify with women plaintiffs, but they might identify with men who suffered from these gender-based discriminations, that several of these cases actually involved laws, state rules that, again, treated men and women differently and, in mm-hmm. fact, disadvantaged men. Which was more likely to get the justice's attention. Now, it was never any doubt what Justice Ginsburg's ultimate objective was, which was to get equal rights for women. Mm-hmm. But by focusing on cases where men had been disadvantaged by gender differences in the law, mm-hmm. she made a lot of progress.
You're talking about the man who is sitting here with us right now. So let me bring into the program Stephen Weisenfeld. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
And before we dive in, just set up this case for us, will you, Jeff?
Well, this case is so personal and so extraordinary. And so, I mean, it's such an incredibly dramatic story. With all due respect, I think we should let Stephen tell this is, of course, a major American landmark, but it's rooted in a personal tragedy in your life.
Mm. Well, yes. What happened is that my wife passed away in childbirth in way back in 1972. And when I went to the Social Security office to collect a widow's benefit, they said that it wasn't available to me because I'm not a widow. I'm a widower. Mm. And I asked what would happen if I appealed it, because Social Security had an appeals process that you could use. And the clerk that I was talking to just said, well, you would just lose anyway. So at that particular point, I just went home and tried to think about ways to pursue this kind of thing.
And here you're a dad, and you've just lost your beloved, your wife, and you have a baby son, Jason Paul. And you're thinking, how am I going to be the two parents? How am I going to provide for him and my family? And then you're being told, no, because you're a man, you're not afforded the same benefits.
How did Ruth Ginsburg get involved in the case?
Yeah, how did she see
that? Okay, Ruth was teaching at Rutgers University. This letter is in the New Brunswick Home News. Rutgers is in New Brunswick. I live in Edison, which is across the Raritan River from New Brunswick, so that's my local newspaper. And there was this article in early November now, so some months have passed by, that talked about alternate lifestyles. And I thought to myself, well, I can use this alternate lifestyle idea to indicate what problem I'm having, and maybe somebody will see that and point me in the right direction. Well, it turned out that a woman named Phyllis Zaitlin Boring, who was also a professor at Rutgers University, knew Ruth, And they had started an organization called WEAL, Women's Equal Action League, together. Mm-hmm. And it was Phyllis Zaitlin Boring who contacted me via mail and asked me if I'd like to pursue this case further. And I pointed out to her in the letter, returnal letter, that that's exactly what I would like to do. That's why I wrote the letter, hoping somebody like you would direct me in the right, point me in the right direction. So she put me in touch with Ruth. That's how I got to know Ruth.
And what did Ruth say? I mean, what were your interactions with her like?
Ruth's first telephone conversation took place sometime in early December. And she asked, told me all about what she was, what the plan was, what she was going to do, how she was going to approach things. And she asked some very important questions because I had to be situated in a position so that I would be able to collect the benefit. So at that particular point in time, I was. Some of the things were, was the infant child in my care? Well, he was. Was I earning more than a certain amount of money? At this particular point, I had a business. I sold the business to be able to stay home and take care of Jason a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I was not yet re-employed anyplace. So I didn't have an income at that particular point. So that was an important qualification. Another one was that the spouse that passed away, my wife, had been working and paying money into the Social Security system, which she had. She was a school teacher and was paying maximum contributions into Social Security for 7 years at that point. And so all those qualifications were met that she was looking for. And we got together then in February, and she filed in a 3-judge federal court, which was in Trenton, which we were heard in Trenton in June. This is 1973. Now, and they took some time to decide their opinion. At the point when we were at that 3-judge federal court in June, I was employed and earning a lot of money at that particular point, and I really didn't qualify to be in that court because the United States Attorney pointed out that the minimum remedy had to be $10,000. And I was earning more money than would allow me. I would not be allowed to collect any Social Security benefit. So that was very disturbing to me. And I really didn't want to stop this case from going forward because it had a lot of meaning to me. Not just because I would stand to receive a benefit. My benefit was going to be $206 a month. It didn't really have that much meaning. But one of the reasons why I was here is because for 7 years, my wife had been putting money into the Social Security system. Where'd that money go? Mm. Women were paying into the system, and the money got lost. And this was in the age of equal rights, and so I was very aware of these kinds of things at the time. The Equal Rights Amendment was never approved. And I was living in New Jersey, and New Jersey turned it down. Mm. So the amendment never passed. So the money she was paying in was important. And later on in the story, there are, of course, my benefit, the son, and the way the Supreme Court ruled is important.
But, did you win in the 3-judge panel?
So I did win. All three justices voted in my favor. So the disturbance to me at that particular point, backing up to what I was talking about, is that when I heard that happening, I managed to lose my job. Mm. And so the case would be able to go forward. And I didn't tell anybody I was doing it for that purpose. Because
that's interesting.
Ruth would not let me do it just so she could handle the case. Right. And my parents, I was a young man at the time, my parents were still alive, they would not let me give up a job to collect a $200 a month benefit.
Right. But you did.
But I did.
So this makes its way to the Supreme Court. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg is the one to argue your case in front of the court. The night before she is going to she calls you the night before she's going to argue this in front of the court, and you end up sitting beside her as she does. And we'll talk about that in a moment, but I just want people to listen and hear part of her oral argument.
This absolute exclusion, based on gender per se, operates to the disadvantage of female workers, their surviving spouses, and their children. It denies the female worker social insurance family coverage of the same quality as the coverage available under the account of a male worker. It denies the surviving spouse of a female worker the opportunity to care personally for his child, an opportunity afforded the surviving spouse of a male worker. and it denies the motherless child an opportunity for parental care afforded the fatherless child.
What did she tell you, Stephen, about her strategy and about having you sit right there next to her?
The night before, we had a telephone conversation in which she told me that she felt that we were going to get a 4-4 affirmation, Justice Douglas not sitting at the time, and 4-4 was enough to affirm the lower court's decision. And she, in order to do that, she wanted to be sure that she got Potter Stewart's vote. And her argument was phrased in terms that Potter Stewart had used in some of the decisions that he wrote, so that she would be talking directly to him most of the time while she was making her argument, and she was as Potter Stewart's vote that she was looking for. And the next day, she sat me at the table with her. She had never before had a client sit at the table and hadn't done it afterward. I was the only client to ever sit there. I was not introduced, and she just wanted to show the eight male justices what a male looked like when he was the plaintiff.
So great. But it didn't turn out to be 4-4. It turned out to be 8-0.
Turned out to be 8-0. And boy, we were all surprised at that. There were three different opinions handed down. There was the one that felt it was discrimination against the woman because she paid the money into Social Security. There was part of that group concurred with that it was discrimination against the male who was denied the opportunity to collect the benefit.
You.
That was me. And just one justice, Justice Rehnquist, probably the most conservative justice on the court at the time, said it was discrimination against the baby. And they always laugh about that when she tells the story. And Nina Totenberg once pointed out on PBS right after the advise and consent hearings for the Supreme Court in 1993, that any time Justice Rehnquist sees Ruth Ginsburg walking in the hall, she always asks, "How's the baby? How's the baby?" She said, right?
Jason is long ago stopped being a baby, but Ruth Ginsburg has remained in your life and remained in Jason's life.
Yes, we stay in touch frequently. Ruth married my son, and he also, in 2014, 4 years ago, married my current wife, Elaine.
And you.
Who's outside, and me, and we were married at the Supreme Court.
Oh. So we
stay in touch with each other. In fact, we're having dinner together in 2 weeks.
Where are you having dinner?
Today.
Can we come?
Yeah, sure. Well, if you're in D.C., you could come. We're going to be in Washington.
Venue
wasn't selected yet.
You really do. I mean, this was more than just an attorney-client relationship. This developed into a decades-long friendship. And you brought with you some of the letters, some of your correspondence, even recent correspondence between you and Justice Ginsburg.
Mm-hmm.
You want to share some?
Sure. Anything particular that you're looking at?
Yes, actually. The letter dated December 29th, 2016, she talks about the election.
She did write a sentence about the election. She said in that letter, she said, "Of course, I'm disappointed by the election results, but determined to do all I can to stay healthy at least until 2020.
So that tells us a few things, Jeffrey. We know because of public statements, she's not a fan of President Trump. It also sort of said, at least until 2020, that she doesn't think he'll get elected again. I suppose.
Well, I
don't know.
I
what do you
think
make
she's
of
probably taking it one term at a time. I mean, she's currently 85. In 2020, she'll be 87.
Mm-hmm.
I think she's, I mean, you know, the numbers being what they are, I think she's probably thinking one term at a time. But I mean, knowing Ginsburg as we do, if President Trump is reelected, she'll write the same letter to Stephen and say, "I'm going to try to hang on until 2024.
But I mean, most Supreme Court justices wouldn't write that.
No, I mean, I don't think so. But I just want to take
the opportunity to point out here that even though there's a lot of flack about what she had said, making a political comment a couple of years ago, that she's not the first and only justice who have made political comments.
She, as I said, you guys keep in touch. Obviously, you're having dinner in a few weeks. She chose Asheville, North Carolina, where you live, as the location for a conference. The North Carolina Bar was hosting this in her honor. And she went there along with Marty, her late husband, before he passed. Tell me about that.
Okay, so she wrote me a letter about it a year and a half before this actually took place. Mm-hmm. And when she's pointing out the date, she underlined it in pen on the typewritten letter. She underlined it on pen, so I realized that it's not this. It was a day in November, was it? Or October, I forget what month it was. Not this year, but next year, because she wrote the letter that she wrote to me was in the summertime. And she came for the conference, and Marty was there, her husband Marty was there. And interesting thing happened. Marty, you know, these guys are they're really nice. They're very humorous people. When one event that we had went to, I was wearing a tie, and Marty wasn't. So Marty said, to put me at ease, why don't you take your tie off? And so I thought, okay, and I did. Later that evening, we were having dinner together. So I showed up without a tie, thinking that was the way that they dressed, but Marty had a tie on. So I immediately pointed that out. You know, now you're wearing a tie and I'm not. So he said, well, wait a second. Then he just took his tie off. I thought that was really, really
making cute. You feel comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, while they were there, this was a conference. So a lot of people there, mostly made up of attorneys at North Carolina Bar, and a lot of judges, and they came from faraway places as well. I had several comments from people while we were there that Justice Ruth Ginsburg and I seemed very close. That they were very impressed with the fact that I could just walk up and talk to her, and I went over to the table. I wasn't sitting at the same table for dinner one night when the conference was meeting. And I just walked over to the table and took out the photo album. Just leaned down and started showing her and Marty these pictures.
Yeah.
And you know, judges came over to me and said, how do you get to be so brave to sit down next to somebody so esteemed as a Supreme Court justice? And it never even occurred to me.
Huh.
Well, they didn't know that, you know, you were a client. You weren't just some friend. Yeah.
Can you, Jeff, talk about just, you know, the fact, again, this was expected to be a 4-4 decision, just uphold the lower court. It ends up being 8-0. Just how big this was for history.
Well, and also just how important these sort of men's rights cases turned out to be.
For equal rights.
For equal rights. I mean, the idea that, you know, widowers didn't get treated the same way as widows by the Social Security Administration. You know, another case, which is, you know, sort of a silly case, but it indicative from this period, was Oklahoma said men could buy beer at 21, but women, girls, could buy beer at 18.
Because they thought we were more responsible?
Were more responsible, and they didn't, and they thought they, you know, that men were more reckless, and, you know, the reasoning is difficult to fathom, but, you know, again, it was discrimination against men, but again, it created, as did Stevens' case, this momentum in the law that any sorts of distinctions between the sexes would be seen by the courts as unconstitutional, and that's and that was what RBG really wanted was that momentum, and it.
And she, by the way, this was, she knew exactly what she was doing here, and this was very purposeful, presenting men being discriminated against to fight for equal women's rights.
Right, which was not a intuitively obvious strategy, but, you know, as now historians are looking at, you know, Stephen, sorry to break it to you, but you're now part of history. You're not, and you know, the history of this era has been written. RBG's insight about using men to advance women's rights is seen as one of these, you know, enormous.
She had the theory that right from early on, she had the theory that injustices or the special privileges that women had hurt everybody, and that didn't just put the women on a pedestal, but it hurt men also. And she was always, anytime she's pointing out something of discrimination about women, she always would like to be able to show how it discriminates against men as well.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for being here. I've read about you for years, and meeting you in the flesh, and those letters are fascinating. Thanks for bringing them.
Thank you.
Next, we'll speak with Sharon Cohen, a woman whose case for equality RBG fought back in the 70s.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
All right, so let's talk about some of the other big cases that Justice Ginsburg, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, argued, Jeffrey, before the Supreme Court. One of them is a famous case, Frontiero v. Richardson. And joining us now is formerly Sharon Frontiero, now Sharon Cohen, who served as a lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force after she graduated from college. Sharon, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Tell us how you ended up suing the Secretary of Defense, Elliot Richardson.
Well, I was 23 years old. I was straight out of college, just like you said. I had just gotten married, and I realized that I wasn't getting the housing allowance that men were getting, married men were getting. And it was not insignificant. I was making about $500 a month for my base salary, and the housing allowance was another $120 a month. It was enough to get an apartment. So I thought it was a mistake. I started going through the channels you go through, the payroll office, the personnel office, and, you know, I was very young. And I look back, and I'm almost embarrassed at how young I was at 23. But even though I started hearing, what do you expect? Your husband should be supporting you. You're lucky we let you in the service at all.
Ugh.
Even though I started hearing that, I still thought it was an administrative mistake. I thought somehow they just don't understand that I got married and I have to present the right set of documents. I was stationed in Montgomery, Alabama at Maxwell Air Force Base. And Montgomery has always been a civil rights kind of percolator, and that's where the Southern Poverty Law Center was. So we went and talked to a lawyer there who was really the first person who said to me, there is no administrative remedy for this. This is endemic sexual discrimination. And if you want to file a lawsuit, we'd be very happy to file a lawsuit for you. And it was at that point, you know, I had gone from being really naive and just wanting my money to being a little bit pissed off at what I was hearing.
You do say you didn't actually bring this case because you're a feminist. You brought it because you needed the money.
Yes, I wasn't a feminist. I was really young, and I was from a blue-collar, hard-working family. I put myself through college. A lot of stuff was going on around me that I just was not aware of. I was just focused on my own personal life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So when I started hearing this stuff, you know, I liken it to somebody who gets a hearing aid. This is what I've heard from people who get a new hearing aid. Their expectation is that they're going to very clearly hear the person they're talking to, but the reality is they hear everything in the room. And I think when I started hearing what I was hearing, I started hearing it all. And that's the point at which I became a feminist. And it was a heady time for feminism. There were a lot of consciousness-raising groups briefs and books out, and, you know, there was a lot of stuff going on. The ERA was barreling through the states. We didn't expect it to stop barreling. It did, but...
The Equal Rights Amendment. Yeah.
Yeah.
How did the case get from the Southern Poverty Law Center to Ruth Bader Ginsburg?
The Southern Poverty Law Center, my lawyer there was Joe Levin, filed the case at the Supreme Court, and it's my understanding that the ACLU filed an amicus brief, and that he gave her 10 out of the 30 minutes of the oral argument. I think he did 10, she did 10, he did 10 mm-hmm. of the oral argument.
So she appeared as, she was not your official lawyer. She was amicus. But was this an example of how the law made assumptions about a male breadwinner versus a female breadwinner? Because the assumption underlying the law was that, you know, a male breadwinner in the armed services needed the money for his family. And the idea that there might be a female breadwinner just didn't occur to the people, or they didn't care, or they opposed it, the people who set up this administrative structure.
Right. It was actually a little bit more complicated than that. It was that a woman could file to have her husband declared dependent on her, but it was pretty onerous, and I would have had to have supplied 76% of all of our family's income. He had to be dependent on me for more than 50% of his income for us to have him declared a dependent, whereas men automatically got it. And my husband had some GI benefits. He was in school. He had a part-time job at night. You know, we were young people who were scrabbling together a bunch of jobs, just like the man I was working with. So it wasn't exactly that women could never get the housing allowance. It was just very onerous, and every single one of us had to prove it, whereas men never had to prove it. They could be married to a Rockefeller and not have to prove it.
So you lose initially, though. You lose front of the district court panel.
We were in a district court, and I think that my lawyer, I certainly expected to win. You know, it seemed like such a patent injustice to me. It seemed like such a slam dunk that anybody with half a brain would say, oh, yeah, this isn't fair. But the two of the three judges in the three-judge federal panel said that because there were so many men and so few women, it was administratively inconvenient to get the government to ask all men.
Jeff
to go Tubin's
process. Laughing at this.
No, I mean, it doesn't even make sense on its own terms.
Oh, you know what?
That argument. I mean, because it should be administratively harder because there's so many more men,
right?
Yeah.
Than there are women. I mean, it's ridiculous.
The line was, women are not being denied a right; men are being given a windfall.
Oh, wow.
Right.
So the Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU obviously see it differently. This gets brought up, you know, this gets heard by the Supreme Court, of course. And let's listen to part of Ruth Bader Ginsburg arguing in front of the court.
In asking the court to declare sex a suspect criterion, amicus urges a position forcibly stated in 1837 by Sarah Grimke, noted abolitionist, an advocate of equal rights for men and women. She spoke, not elegantly, but with unmistakable clarity. She said, I ask no favor for my sex. All I ask of our brethren is that they take their feet off our necks.
And you won.
Yeah, well,
but you didn't,
we won. It was 8-1. I think Rehnquist dissented. But four of the justices were on our side on basis of strict scrutiny, and the other four on the basis of rational basis. Is that right?
That's right. And that goes back to a conversation Poppy and I were having earlier, which remains an unresolved area of constitutional law, which is whether discrimination against women under the 14th Amendment is treated exactly the same way as discrimination on the basis of race. Mm-hmm. Race has traditionally been the area where there is strict scrutiny, where the court will almost never justify any sort of distinction. It remains somewhat murky what the standard is for discrimination on the basis of gender, and that division is reflected in the 4-4 distinction between the justices, who are all on your side, but under different reasons.
That she didn't have this plurality of justices on the court establishing in their opinion that gender discrimination is inherently suspect.
Correct. I remember when I interviewed Justice Ginsburg for my New Yorker story, she told me a story about, and I think it was your case, because I think it involved the Department of Defense, is that when the Department of Defense filed their brief in one of the cases where she was the lawyer, as an example of how upsetting to the system it would be if the plaintiff won, the judges said, the Defense Department said, look at all these other rules that we have that treat men and women differently. These rules would have to be thrown out as well. And for Ginsburg, this was an incredible gift.
Yeah.
Because she then said, we're going to attack all these rules. Thank you for putting them all in one place. We could never have found them ourselves.
Yeah, thank you for opening that closet door.
Right, and that was your case, wasn't it?
I don't know, but that's very funny.
Yes, no, but it was that she tells that story with such delight.
Yeah.
That the Department of Defense essentially did her work for her of ferreting out every place that they discriminate against women.
We talked to a lot of reporters during that time, my husband and I, and we were young. They were young. They were happy to chat with us. And I remember one of them told us that the unhappiest people they had talked to were the Defense Department's lawyers. Hmm. They really wanted to be on our side.
It's interesting.
Well,
you had said, Jeff, in a previous episode of the podcast, for the VMI decision that Justice Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion for, she cited some of the cases that she'd argued before the court. Do you know if this was one of them?
I don't know off the top of my head, but certainly, I mean, we are privileged to talk to. I mean, this is no joke. I mean, Steven Weisenfeld and Sharon Frontiero Cohen are major figures in American legal history because their names are attached to these civil rights landmarks.
And mark this in history for us. How significant?
Well, I mean, this was an especially important case, the Frontiero case, because the justices were always, and to this day, very differential to anything involving military judgment. That if the justices often say, like, we're not going to second guess the military.
Yeah.
We're not going to tell them how to run their business, how to run a war. We're not going to tell them. So the fact that, Sharon's case established the principle that even though on Army bases or any branch of the armed services, most of the officers and most of the enlisted people are men, you can't treat women differently financially. And it's an enormously important principle, both as a legal matter, but also socially, that it was one of the many changes in the society that told women, you know what? You can go in the armed services. You can make a career in the military. And that, has had enormous implications for how, what kind of military we have.
You're so right to note how fascinating it is and fortunate we are to have Sharon Cohen, Sharon Frontiero, with us. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to our 70s episode of RBG Beyond Notorious. On the next and final episode, we will go back to the beginning. We'll talk about how RBG got her start in the legal profession in the 50s and the 60s.
On The Law Review, Ruth was treated with reverence because we knew how good she was.
Her story continues next. Don't forget to watch the CNN film RBG this fall.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.